Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to another New Energy Chinwag with myself, John Massey, and Charlie Rattan. Hi, Charlie.
Yeah, good day to you.
Right, today we thought we'd talk about something which I think we've mentioned in passing, but not really spent any time on, which is CCS, carbon capture and storage. It's something, I mean, it's not new. It's something that's been around for a while. It exists in various parts of the world, not many parts of the world. We can maybe come on to that. It's got a lot more interest recently, I would say, particularly from a policy side, in view of things like net zero targets. Certainly here in the UK, if you read the documents that led to the net zero legal commitment by the government, the background to that was a lot of the documents kind of basically came to the conclusion that without CCS, it was going to be very difficult and nigh on impossible to achieve some of these targets. So we'll see what happens from a policy point of view, but it certainly seems to be coming to the fore a bit more. Charlie, what was your interest in CCS particularly?
Yeah, like you said, John, those of us that have been around in the energy sector for a few years will certainly have come across carbon capture and storage in various guises over the years. And in fact, I seem to remember previous big pushes for it, perhaps about 15 or so years ago, with competitions and glossy prizes and all kinds of highfalutin entrants. But like some of the things that we've talked about in other podcasts, it tends to be a bit cyclical, and it tends to revolve around some kind of straight support or some kind of disguised support. And if that support is withdrawn or melts away, lo and behold, so does the CCS element of it. But nevertheless, I've come across it in various guises. I suppose the biggest one that I came across as a viable scheme was a bit of a bolt-on. When I was at E.ON, there was a scheme called King's North, which I think was a thermal plant in Kent. And I think one of the things that was out there was a carbon capture and storage element. But I think that was rather more in theory than reality. And it hit some surprising blockers within other elements of the European company. So it wasn't necessarily that the technology might not have worked. I think what had happened in King's North is that a square acre of land was designated. And when the planning went in, this is where the carbon capture and storage will go. Further details will be provided. And then it was watered down and King's North wasn't actually built. So it was a little bit irrelevant. But I think the bigger picture was that some of the company, which I'm not going to name, looked at that and said, well, hold on, this could be a bit of a Pandora's box. If we put this in, we will be expected to put this technology into all our kit, including existing kit. And like so much else in the energy sector, it's not cheap. So perhaps it's another reason why that never really took off. But like you say, it's reappeared, and I wonder whether you'd like to cast some light on it, why it may have reappeared.
Yeah, so I think the why is the realization that if you want to, if there's an urgency around removing carbon from a policy point of view, and you look at some of the timescales it would take to completely replace the carbon emissions at the moment, so that would be not just power generation but transport, heat, industry and so on, then what you're going to probably have to do, given that this is a transition, not flicking a switch, is in that transition to speed up the removal of carbon is to start storing it. So I think it very much comes from it's coming from that side of things. I think there's also, as with all these things, from a business point of view, there are motivations obviously around money making opportunity. If you're in the oil and gas sector at the moment, the carbon capture and storage that is happening around the world is mostly oil and gas sector carbon capture and storage for what they call enhanced oil recovery. So they have expertise there. They see that as a big opportunity. They see that as a way to, again, sell that opportunity, sell that expertise, scale that up. I've said on a number of occasions they've been paid to take carbon out of the ground. I think some of them are quite happy to be paid to put carbon back into the ground as well. So a nice kind of circular economy there, if you like, from their point of view. So there's some interest driving it from that point of view. It fits into their expertise. It fits into what they can do. So yeah, I think they're the main drivers are from the policy side and from those industries who would stand to benefit and stand to gain from large scale carbon capture and storage. That's really where it's coming from. And as I say, it's less from the power sector, but much more from, I would say, the oil and gas sector.
I suppose the oil and gas sector, they've extracted the oil, they've extracted the gas, that leaves caverns. And those caverns, in theory, could be refilled with something. So what can be pumped out? You could put those pumps, presumably, in reverse and pump something back in. So in some ways, it would be quite a neat solution. Of course, from an oil and gas point of view, it would also perhaps reduce the possibility of stranded assets. It might give a new lease of life. You might need to refurbish the assets and put some kind of reverse capability that wasn't designed in from the outset. And also, like you say, it would. You can see the circularity from their point of view, from a carbon point of view. And I seem to also think, coming back to your policy side, that this does attract CFDs. I'm sure that the CFD covers now carbon capture and storage. I'm sure there was a bit of a policy shift a couple of years ago to encompass that as gaining some kind of support. Is that accurate?
I don't know, actually, on CFD. We'll skip over oil and gas caverns. I don't think my geology doesn't... I don't think you get oil in caverns, but anyway. Well, but yeah, I mean...
Some kind of well.
It's got a pause in the rock. Okay. But yeah, but absolutely. I mean, if they can reuse existing facilities rather than decommission them, then yeah, again, it's a... you've got assets. Why spend to remove them when you can... spend a little bit to reuse them. Yes, CFDs. I'm not sure, actually. No one's actually been awarded a CFD for carbon capture and storage yet. Whether CFDs would be a mechanism through which they would start to do it, I'm not sure. Again, that kind of would rely on CFDs being prioritised towards the power sector, I would imagine, which I don't think it will be. I think there's some CCS in the power sector. Certainly, if you look at the UK, Drax have their what they call bioenergy carbon capture and storage. They're looking at this kind of negative emissions power plant. So converting coal to gas and then to gas and biomass and then capturing the emissions from that. So that'd be one approach. But I think you're also looking at carbon capture and storage in the short run around things like hydrogen production. Blue hydrogen production from natural gas is another big one. In other markets where coal is still a big thing, potentially carbon capture and storage with coal generation. But as I say, I mean, most of it at the moment is actually carbon capture out of oil and gas facilities, doing it that way. So yeah, I mean, where it develops, policy will obviously be crucial because it costs money, and there's not really a value in it. If you're going to get paid to store the carbon, then that's going to put the price of whatever you're producing that produced that carbon up, that's either going to have to be paid by customers, or it's going to have to be subsidised through government policy. I guess either way, it ends up being paid by customers. So you're increasing the cost of doing something rather than just letting the carbon into the air. So that's the key. That's the policy thing. How do you overcome something that costs more compared to just doing nothing with it? And where does that cost accrue? Does that go on the emitters? Are they allowed to pass that on to customers? Or does the state just say, well, it's a common good situation, we'll just add that cost, we'll subsidize that cost, and we'll put it onto taxpayers, bill payers, whatever segment they choose, presumably almost everyone, and do it that way. So
yeah,
I think there's some challenges to how you finance it.
It reminds me of some of our previous discussions, which we have asked that question, who pays? And certainly when we discussed clusters a few weeks ago, I think there was a bit of the elephant room. Is, yeah, it's all very well to have these clusters, but usually there's some special pleading somewhere along the line. People you wouldn't expect to meet. I wouldn't have thought some of the incumbents have been doing infrastructure projects for 50, 60 years and longer would suddenly be asking for extra funds from someone. You would have thought, well, surely they could put a business case. So the carbon capture and storage, I think obviously, I logged onto a cluster, funnily enough, this week, and they use this word net zero. But carbon capture and storage does not get rid of 100% of the carbon, does it? It's not 100%. It's only partial.
Yeah, I mean, you hear claims up to, like, I think the HyNet, the proposal in the Northwest, the one that you reference quite a lot, which is blue hydrogen, they're talking about 93% carbon capture, I think, for that one. I think currently it's probably lower than that. I don't know off the top of my head, but I think normally you're talking about figures, anywhere as low as kind of 80% up to 90%. So I think 95% is kind of the maximum, I think, I've heard people talking about. It's one of those where there's kind of diminishing returns. You kind of, to eke out those last few percentages, you'd have to spend more and more and more on the capture side of it. So you're not getting rid of it all. It's not net zero, certainly. And obviously you've got the storage part of it. You've got to have somewhere suitable that you can put it. You've got to have either depleted oil and gas fields or some other, or, well, you could have caverns. You could have kind of things like salt caverns, I suppose. You can have those kind of, you've got to have the right geology, basically, somewhere that you can actually put a gas underground where it's not going to trickle out over time.
Yeah. So I came across one up at Hunterston where I was developing an offshore turbine test facility, but adjacent to that was a coal plant, clean coal plant. And I think that was excavated in the public domain because they'd claimed it was net zero or whatever word was in vogue at the time, but it was quite clear it wasn't. And I think and that didn't play well at all. And I think the advice was to come back when it is net zero, which they obviously couldn't do. And it's not just about the caverns, I suppose, the pipes, and there are other areas from the wider scheme where you might get some kind of a leak and not meet your own criteria. So if you were to think about from a net zero point of view, is it what most people would think of a net zero solution? Or could you argue, look, it's just a stepping stone, it's a transition, but the transition, why would you invest in that when you could invest in something green? And that is net zero, it might cost a few quid more, but aren't we just propping up old kit effectively under a different
glass? I guess you'd argue it's a carbon reduction. Yes, net zero. I suppose then you get into arguments about is anything really net zero when you look at embedded carbon costs of manufacturing things and all that kind of stuff. But with carbon capture, certainly, I guess the argument is, well, if you can reduce it, even if it's only by it was 80%, if that's still 80% less carbon than you were chucking into the atmosphere before, then is that not worthwhile doing? But yes, then you could say, well, in the long run, maybe that's a transitional step before you don't need to be producing the carbon in the first place. I think there are, I guess the other thing, without being an expert on the capture technology, is I do know it makes a difference in terms of cost and ease of capture, how that carbon is being produced, in particular how concentrated it is within the kind of gas stream you're trying to collect it from. So there'll be some applications, I think there'll be some industrial applications, for example, where it might be easier to capture or cheaper to capture at high percentages than in other applications. I think one of the issues with power plants, I think, is it adds so much cost to capture the carbon in the first place, because it's quite a small percentage of the stream going out. That's a problem to the economics then of the power plant. So there are a number of factors that go in, but yeah, then you'd have to look at it's not just, I think that's the thing with carbon capture and storage. People think about the capture bit, but they're often not thinking about the storage bit, which means you've got to get it from where you capture it to where you're going to store it. Now, if that's not close by, that's a whole bunch of extra infrastructure. Okay. And even if it is close by, you've got to have the right geology, you've got to have the infrastructure to inject it back into the ground.
Okay. Given the fact that we've said this has been kicking around a long time in different guises, perhaps there are timing issues that might work in its favour, and a few other unexpected issues. First of all, for anybody that's looked through what they call an agreement for lease with the Crown Estate regarding seabed, and that actually says you've got to leave the seabed in the same state as you found it. And if you don't, you really, really need to justify it. So you could argue, actually, if you're going to pump something back in, actually, we took out gas and we're putting back something, or you're putting some physical thing back in to fill the cavern or well or whatever you want to call it. So you could actually argue that that's quite close to the AFL stipulation, which might play legally. A second thing is that the timings might be better now than they were 15 years ago. I do know in the Irish Sea, for example, that some of the assets there have only got a few years of life left in them. So you wouldn't be minded to push this 15 years ago when, you know, there's another 15, 18 years left of resource to be pumped out. But now, given the fact that projects will certainly take 3 years from now to get up and running, the timing might be right. Also, this word net zero seems to have come into vogue, and obviously you could push the boundaries to what, certainly if you tied the word transition with it. And I think you've come also, I think you've hit the nail on the head regarding why perhaps that utility didn't push ahead. And I think the argument was that carbon capture and storage, we know that each element works, but there's been no real major project where it's actually been done commercially in the real world. So it's all theoretical, and there's no reason why it shouldn't do, but that's different from being bankable. As you know, I suppose the banks might have something to say about the innovative and high-risk nature of it. I think you indicated at the start of the conversation that there are carbon capture and storage facilities operational now. So we do have presumably some data as to how these are performing. Whether
not many. I mean, there's last year there's a thing called the Carbon Capture and Storage Institute, which obviously is pushing this kind of stuff. They do a report every year, and it's good. It's worth a read. It's got lots of data in it. Last year there were 19 what they call large scale carbon capture and storage facilities, and that's globally. So we're not talking about tens and hundreds. That was 19 in total anywhere in the world. So it's not big scale. It's fairly limited. You'd have to delve into the report. A lot of those were, as I say, enhanced oil recovery. So they were, the rationale for doing it was you've got oil fields, gas fields coming towards end of life. To squeeze more out of them, you push carbon dioxide in. So I think you're absolutely right. A big driver for this coming again from the industry side is you've got depleted fields rather than just abandon them, wander off. How can we use it? So yeah, let's jump on the fact that policy is all about net zero or low carbon or whatever you want to call it, and say, well, yeah, we've got this geology here when we can we've taken the gas out, we can easily stuff another one back in and contribute to some of these climate saving problems that policymakers are concerned about currently. So I think there's a big driver there. And then that becomes a bit of a kind of lobbying game as to, look, you've said that we need carbon capture storage. We've got these gas fields that we can use, but we need a bit of help from you in terms of justifying the cost and so on. So I think that's what kind of where we are, I think, in most in most areas. I mean, I say most areas, it's Europe really I've seen interest. I'm not aware in Asia, I've not come across anything in Asia particularly talking about carbon capture and storage. I think in the States there's a little bit, but Europe, and particularly around the North Sea, there seems to be quite a lot of drive towards it. I mean, arguably because Europe is the region where you've got more countries who have got commitments and time schedules and so on around carbon reduction.
Yeah, I think there's some scheme with Equinor and a couple of other big majors linking up in the press in the last couple of
weeks. Yeah, there's one in Norway.
The North Sea would be attractive to them, existing oil and gas area with existing facility and plant and network of pipelines already in place.
That was Equinor, Shell and Total, I think. And it's a thing called Northern Lights.
Yeah, that's
it. What they were talking about was capturing carbon actually from industrial facilities around Oslo. it's a complex chain. So they were going to capture it there. Then they were going to move it by boat around to the West Coast and then inject it into, presumably gas fields out in the North Sea. So again, they're not capturing particularly close to where they're storing it. So I think they'd agreed on how much it was going to cost, which was something like $700 million from memory. It was a reasonable chunk of money. And I think they're just going through kind of regulatory approvals and so on with the Norwegian government at the moment. But that was lots of news because I think that's probably, that's the first kind of sizable announcement, I would say, that we've seen. Certainly in the UK, there's been lots of talk about it, but I'm not aware of anyone that's actually kind of put numbers on it or said, okay, this is how much it costs, here's where we're going to do it. As I say, HyNet, the project up in the northwest, has certainly got carbon capture and storage as part of
their blue. There's one called Acorn up at Aberdeen as well. It tends to revolve around the gas transmission points on the UK network. Yeah. So if you look at St Fergus, and this is where I think even 15 years ago people were looking, and then this competition, I think Shell and SSE linked up together and progressed it. And then I seem to remember, it might be a false memory, that there was some competition funding which then dried up and that just withered away. Mm. As did the industry, you know, they put it on a shelf and moved on to other things. And now, with net zero and the further depletion of the resources, and another factor that we've sometimes discussed, the on the hook for pretty hefty decommissioning costs somewhere down the line. Yeah. You know, not forget that one as a driver. It's perhaps to pull it back off the shelf. Dust it down, look at what the policy is. Oh, look, there's CFD now, and there's a net zero agenda, and look, it might meet the circular agenda. Let's bring it back in and see what happens.
Yeah, CFDs I'd have to look into, but I mean, the Shell one was going to be, that was kind of a competition, wasn't it? I think it was going to be, that was going to be a straight grant, I think. Yeah. And I think there have been a few R&D type grants around CCS that the government have done, but on a larger scale, you'd need some kind of more general policy. I think either you could either mandate it, you could just say, well, you can't emit, or you can't emit 100%. You've got to capture 20% of what you emit, and it doesn't matter whoever you are, whether you're a power plant, whatever else, industrial facility, etc. So something wide ranging like that, or you put a price on carbon. Now, I mean, we have prices on carbon. There's carbon markets that set a price here, and there's a floor price here that's kind of kicked out coal, but not big enough, certainly nowhere near large enough to start encouraging people to store carbon rather than just emit it. So higher carbon prices will be the other one. So it's cheaper for them to pay to store it than it is to pay the government the price of emitting it. And then beyond that, how else? Yeah, they would, I think they're the two main ways you can look at from a sort of generalized market scheme to do it. Whether, as I say, with CFDs, I'd be interested to know how that would work. I guess, it'd be relevant to kind of new gas plants. So if you wanted to encourage people to build new gas plants with carbon capture and storage, or no one's going to be building new coal plants. So really, I would have thought CFDs would be gas, maybe biomass, I suppose, if you're looking at this idea of kind of negative emissions power plants, where you're not using fossil carbon, but you're also burying the non-fossil carbon. So you're effectively moving, that's not just net zero, but potentially sub-zero, if that's the right term for it. You need, from an investment point of view and from a company point of view, there's going to ultimately have to be something that forces people to do this, because if it's cheaper to just let it emit, then you let it emit.
Can I come back and see whether it can just clarify some of the points? Because there's quite a lot in that answer, a lot of detail in there, but it's something that just caught my attention. But from what you're saying, it's not just power stations and coal plants. You might be looking at industrial producers. And so physically, mechanically, if you wanted a carbon capture, you'd have to go around to each industrial estate or each site, and then on a site-by-site basis, look at how you could carry out that process in situ. It's not a case of just take it off centrally to some repository and do it at some facility. It's a case of going to each individual location. So
yeah, well, I guess the way they do it would be the same as they do it with carbon markets. There's a size now, so they're not going to go down to your little kind of your little bloke running a diesel generator to run his boat yard or whatever. There'll be a kind of size, emitting size at which you have to do these things. So that's the same with carbon markets, isn't it? It's people with a energy consumption or energy bill above a certain amount that have to be involved. So, but you'd be looking, it's things like, I don't know, cement plants, steel plants. I mean, they have huge, if you look at the emissions footprint of cement and steel, it's, I think off the top of my head, I can't remember the percentage, but it's bigger than that. It's bigger than aviation. I mean, they're talking about huge amounts. So you'd be certainly looking at going around to the big cement plants and the big steelworks, and saying, right, you can't just keep chucking carbon out into the air, you've got to capture it. Either we're going to mandate that you have to capture it as a part of your license to keep operating it, or we're going to make it so expensive to emit that we force you to capture. I mean, the other part of it, I think there's going to have to be something like that to make this happen. I mean, obviously there is pressure from shareholders and investors and consumers as well. So if you're a steelworks, for example, there's a bit been made about this idea that you can sell green steel. You might be able to sell green steel at a higher price than conventional steel, because you can certificate in the supply chain process and the production process that you've emitted, if not zero carbon, but less carbon than conventional steel. So, there might be a certain percentage of consumers are prepared to pay a bit more for that. But I would suggest a lot of people end up buying, if it's a lump of steel, it's a lump of steel. They're going to buy on price. So the other mechanism is to make conventional steel more expensive compared to green steel by going down the route of things like pricing or mandates or whatever. Okay.
Coming back to what you said there, which I think there's a lot of interest in there. Is it not the case? I mean, you mentioned a few high emitters, and I think you mentioned cement and steel and possibly aviation. Is it not the case? And I wonder whether there's an argument presenting itself. Some of these guys have got a deregulation or whatever that's called, that they don't actually need to buy in to some of the climate targets at the moment. However, you could say, well, look, guys, we've let you off the hook for the last 15 years. Everybody else has taken the pain. Sadly, now it's your turn. However, it'll be less painful if we were to go down the CCS route. Would that not be a good argument to present and saying, look, it can be done, it will cost, but there's a mechanism to enable you to do it?
Yeah, one of the controversies when the European trading scheme first came out was that the amount of credits that were given to companies like steel companies, they were given huge allowances to begin with, because basically the feeling was it was impossible to meet meet some of the targets without enormous cost. And again, then you've got this, you're back into the whole kind of lobbying balance between, well, if you make it too expensive, we'll go out of business and everyone will just buy the steel from China anyway. So again, it's a lot of these things sound easy, but again, from a policymaker's point of view, there's that tightrope to walk. Especially in the current climate and the kind of virus recovery climate, I guess the tightrope policymakers will walk is, yes, making industry pay for emissions or pay to reduce emissions, but without being seen to just push industry out and have those industries emit anyway in some other country in Southeast Asia or whatever.
Thinking aloud a little bit, I think you mentioned, I think some of the companies have gone bust anyway, despite that. I'm thinking about South Yorkshire, where there is actually a cluster. Surprise, there are a number of these clusters. They all seem to have a refinery somewhere along the line, but they seem to have heavy industrial use, not so surprisingly. But you might say, look, if there is to be a bailout of what I can't remember the name of the site, was it Scunthorpe or whatever, the facility that recently encountered problems?
It might be
coupled with some carbon capture scheme, at least. That would seem to be a logical progression from a state point of view. Say, well, look, you know, you have been exempt from some of the worst emissions, but you've gone bust anyway. So now if we are to rebalance it, we'll do it this way.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of talk at the moment about tying in bailouts with changes in behaviour. That's certainly true with airlines. Now, whether governments will have the kind of, I don't know, fortitude, if you like. What's the other way of, what other words could be used? Whether they will, given, again, the pressure around jobs and competition and so on, how willing they'll be to enforce rules like that. So with airlines, I think most people recognise that most airlines probably are going to need bailouts at some point. And airlines have been notorious at being exempt from lots of things like fuel taxes, for example. And certainly there's been concerns about emissions growth. If we start seeing the same with industry, why not start to tie in bailouts with things like carbon capture or certainly carbon targets, however they want to achieve that? Because I mean, the alternative, of course, in things like steelmaking is not to emit in the first place. So if you, rather than enforce carbon capture, if you just either make the carbon price very high or enforce emissions reductions targets, the alternative is just is to change how you produce the steel so that you don't produce those emissions in the first place. So, I mean, there are examples in Sweden, I think, is probably the most progressive I've seen in terms of the steel industry. Companies there, I can't remember, there's the name, SSAP, yeah, is it something?
Tyson Krupp in Germany are looking at it as well. Yeah. So that's one of the biggest, years, isn't it? It's going to take.
Swedish steel companies has a, I think they've announced something like 2025. They're looking at for having zero carbon steel production, and that's they're not going to do that by carbon capture. They're talking about removing usage of coke and things from the process of replacing them with alternatives like hydrogen or using or electrifying parts of the steelmaking process. And so that there are alternatives to. Obviously, carbon capture and storage is to not emit carbon in the first place. To use different fuels, to use different processes, electrification rather than fossil fuels and so on. But there'll be some industries where that's going to be...
Yeah, if an industry's been in a place, you think the northeast of England, the chemicals and the industrial clusters, they've been 100, these industrial clusters have been there 100 years plus, and you can't suddenly come along with some new fangled law. You have to retrofit to what is there. And actually... Again, there might be a further argument for carbon capture and storage that it is retrofittable, although it's not cheap. All the elements work. It's not going to get rid of 100%, but, you know, it's a transition we're talking about, and it's better than emitting 100%.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess the worry always with when people talk about a transition is that because it's costly to do and because the infrastructure you need to set up, particularly around the storage bit of it, people aren't going to want to invest in that if they think it's only a 10-year or a 15-year transition. So there's, again, I guess you get into the idea then of technology lock-in, that once you've if you spend billions of pounds, and it will be billions of pounds on all this infrastructure for carbon capture and storage, then once you've built that, then does that transition actually happen? Do you slow down the transition because people think, oh, well, I'll just keep using the same technology. I'll emit, but safe in the knowledge that my emissions are just going to be buried under the North Sea somewhere. So that's always the challenge with transition is, and from an investor point of view, again, when people mention the word transition, I guess the concern is you're thinking, well, is it a transition over 50 years or is this something, are you asking me to invest in something that might have a lifetime of 10 years, but then there's new technology appears that means you don't need the carbon emissions in the first place. And so I've invested in all this infrastructure with a long-term payback, which suddenly is, with the transition has moved more quickly and suddenly it's worthless. So back into the kind of stranded assets issue. So I think, I guess that's one of the barriers to going down a carbon capture and storage route. And again, it's kind of ties in with this issue about electrification is, if you invest in that, are you investing in something that a bit like people worry about with oil and gas and so on, you're invested in kind of stranded assets that over a relatively short time frame?
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised at the Northeast one that they were planning to put a gas facility in there and that they were planning to call that a net zero. But I suppose if you define net zero, net zero doesn't mean that there'll be no emissions. It just means, I suppose, it'll be countered by something elsewhere. And I don't know how you would measure that. There must be a mechanism for determining what net zero is actually defined as. And I suppose you'd define it on a national rather than a regional basis, certainly not on a cluster basis.
Yeah, I mean, that's always one of the controversies about net zero, is that the net is the kind of key word. It doesn't mean everything has to be zero, but it means if some things are zero, or more than zero, there have to be other things that are less than zero. So that's when you get into your kind of negative emissions side of things. I think in the UK net zero, it does specifically state that the net zero is within the UK, because that was one of the controversies before, is that we've reduced emissions but we just import lots of things that are manufactured elsewhere with high emissions, whereas I think that was one of the things in the net zero, the sort of 2050 net zero commitment, was that I think it had to account for imported CO2, if you like, offshored CO2 as well. I think I'd have to check the detail of that, but I'm pretty certain you couldn't, because otherwise the get out would be you just offshore all the heavy industry, so that you, it's not your emissions, you don't care about it, and you run an economy based on, I don't know, hotels and software development or something, and suddenly you've got massively low emissions. I'm pretty sure in the UK document it's clear that they're including that offshore side of it as well, so you can't you can't quite get away with it that easily. But yeah, the mechanism is for tracking it.
Something interesting there, and that there are perhaps strategic industries as well that you really, really don't want to, and I would certainly put steel in that category, certainly if you can think of some of the military type of and possibly nuclear might be in that category for strategic rather than pure commercial reasons as well. They might be disguised military. But come back to carbon capture and storage and the difference, I suppose, and I think you touched upon it in your answer there, the difference between carbon capture and underground storage, which presumably is whatever you want to call them, the wells and the caverns, and then carbon capture and storage. So is there another mechanism of storing? Is some kind of giant tank? What is the mechanism other than underground?
Well, I mean, the problem is if we're talking about carbon capture and storage and making a climate different, I mean, you've got to store it ideally forever. There's no point storing it for 100 years and then dribbling it out into the atmosphere a bit later on. That just you're just delaying emissions rather than storing. So so that would be why you wouldn't store as a gas on the surface. I mean, there are the other term that's kind of sneaked into the lingo is this idea of carbon capture utilization,
right,
and storage, CCUS. So looking at, for example, capturing carbon and then using it as a feedstock for producing chemicals or plastics, that kind of thing, which again is, on the one hand, if you capture carbon, for sake of argument, capture carbon coming out of a power plant and then use that to make plastic for whatever purposes, it means you're not having to pump more oil out of the ground for carbon to produce that plastic. So there's a kind of offset thing there. I guess the issue is that when that plastic bag or plastic wrapper or whatever it is reaches the end of its life, what happens to the carbon then? Because if the carbon then, if it goes in an incinerator and the carbon ends up in the chimney 5 or 10 years down the line, then you've stored it very briefly, but on a geological time frame, it's just gone straight up into the atmosphere again. There's a number of companies looking at basically producing kind of building materials. So capturing carbon and using it to basically make sort of mineral stone materials, which you can use for buildings, and if you build a building, then you could argue, well, that carbon might sit there for 100 years or 200 years in that building. But again, it's on a geological timescale, that's the blink of an eye. If then that building material eventually is dissolved down by the elements and the carbon disappears off into the atmosphere again, you've not really achieved anything. So there's quite a bit of interest in those, and there's companies making carbon fiber out of carbon, captured carbon and all that kind of stuff. So that's quite interesting. The advantage there is that carbon has a value. So instead of having to pay to dispose of it, you create a product which has a value that you can sell. So the economics potentially are better of you making use of the carbon for a product which then generates an income, rather than just treating carbon as something where you have to slap a big penalty on it to get rid of it. But I'm a bit dubious at the moment about some of those carbon capture and utilization things. In terms of this idea of long-term removing carbon out of the air, because are you really doing it for long-term, or are you just doing it temporarily before it ends up back in the air anyway? So those are kind of the alternatives at the moment.
Okay, thinking of where we are now, we've mentioned the clusters, we've talked about them in previous podcasts, and we've talked about decarbonisation of oil and gas as well, which is relevant to this discussion. What would you anticipate going forward? Do you think the government will pick a couple of clusters and say, yeah, we'll trial it on a couple, we'll try this carbon capture and storage in this location and this location, or are they going to be in the mix against other clusters, or are the clusters, could you work in hard? Could the one that you mentioned, a negative cluster or a negative scheme, could that be allied to the carbon capture one, and that would be net zero. If one is less and one is more, you could argue that actually overall, the two together are indeed net zero.
Yeah, I mean, I think to take it forward, ultimately, these the various clusters which are talking about doing carbon capture and storage, use this part of other things like power production, hydrogen production, refining, whatever else it may be. Some of those won't get funding and won't happen. Others will. I think for those to progress, I suspect they'll probably ultimately need some government funding in there as well, by whatever mechanism. I would hope it's not just giving them the money, but I don't know, maybe not having a stake in the project or something, but basically government putting money in and maybe making a return back on it if the project works, but taking on some of the risk, which makes other finance possible. I can't see they're not going to suddenly come out and say, right, we've got a massive strategy to build 10 big carbon capture and storage facilities here. They'll leave it to the market to some extent. They'll put regulations in place, I think, which will either, I don't know, however they do it, increase carbon prices or mandate some level of storage for certain industries. Probably carbon prices, but who knows? But then the market will determine which of these clusters makes the most business sense, can get investment from elsewhere. The government might put some money in, and it'll start with two or three examples, I would have thought, to prove that it works. The classic, can they build it on time and on budget? I mean, that. A lot of these proposals have their kind of, we're going to spend this much, but I mean, do people believe that that's all they'll spend, or will these things overrun? Will it be more complicated than they thought? So, and until the government wants to go full in on this, until the industry can show them, look, this is viable, it's cost effective, and so on. So I think they'll be kind of privately run cluster type initiatives, but I don't think that they'll happen without some level of government.
You mentioned that it's not necessarily a global picture, it's perhaps more of a European picture. And you mentioned also the scheme Northern Star. So I suppose that would be the front runner and the ones that others will watch to see. And even that seems to be quite a kind of quirky scheme from the way you described it, with a few unexpected elements. Yeah. Nevertheless, somebody will have done a business analysis and a business case, and it seems to be... Yeah.
Northern Lights. I think it's timeframes. I mean, these things aren't going to happen overnight. I think they're talking about starting operations in kind of the end of 2024 or something, start of 2025. That type of timescale. These things aren't going to kind of suddenly pop up next year or the year after. We're talking about mid-decade for any kind of sizable schemes to come about. I think people watch that closely. I'd be interesting to know, and I don't know what the commercial basis for that is. What makes that, why the industries involved are doing that? I mean, it might be with some of these projects to begin with. It's not commercially viable on its own. It's a strategic investment. They're saying, look, we think there's policy on the way. We can see the direction. Travel in Europe, particularly around carbon, we think there's policy on the way. Rather than wait for policy and then scramble around to do something about it, we're big companies. We've got deep pockets. We've got shareholders shouting at us about what's our long-term carbon policy. So we're going to spend some R&D money and some. I'm going to spend some money not based on maximum return, but on kind of preparing for the future. So when regulations do come in, we've got a network, we can sign people up much more quickly than someone starting from scratch. So that's why it will be big companies, I think, that will drive this, because they will have the deep pockets able to do that.
Yeah, so you're talking about potential first mover advantage, and I'm sure if you were Shell, you wouldn't be scared of making decisions for 10, 20, 30, even 50 years distant, knowing that certain resources are kind of withering away, and that you will be on the hook for decommissioning costs anyway. So the baseline is not one that you want to address anyway, because something will happen anyway. We talked about this, didn't we, with the hydrogen and the gas network, and how something's going to happen anyway. It's just a case of how you're effective and dealing with the issues out there. Is there anything you think we've not discussed today? And it was quite a thorough discussion today on carbon capture and storage, and it does touch some of the other podcasts, especially around hydrogen and industrial clusters that we've discussed over the last 18 months or so. Is there anything that we've not touched upon that we should have brought into today?
Well, there's things we could obviously go into more detail. I mean, one we've not mentioned, which again, I think is miles away, but is what they call direct air carbon capture, which is not carbon capture associated particularly with a facility, but basically capturing CO2 out of the atmosphere. Now, that's the problem. There is it's minuscule concentrations in the grand scheme of things. So it's hard to capture. It's very expensive. But there's companies looking at that. So if you want, again, almost as an emergency measure, if you're worried about if you can't stop people emitting, then just suck it out of the air.
It's a giant purifying thing, is it?
It's just taking carbon out of the atmosphere on a big scale.
And that is possible. Is this real? Is this already tested, or is this just theoretical?
There are demonstration facilities, and there are people looking at the technology, but it's not commercial. I mean, it's miles off from being commercial. It's hugely expensive to do, is my understanding. There's things like that in the future podcast we could probably look at.
Yeah.
In more detail, but I think realistically in the short term we've kind of correctly identified that the driving force for this is going to be around clusters where you have lots of emitters in a relatively small space, which is going to be kind of industrial, heavy industry type clusters, not necessarily, which is why I don't think it necessarily be power plant driven, although you often get power plants in those same locations, but particularly industry driven. The companies driving it are the ones with the expertise in the storage and the assets in which that they can use for the transport and storage. I think, again, we've identified, I think that's a key part of the motivation here is assets, utilization of assets going forward. So now I think we've covered most of the angle.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose the only thing that I suppose it reiterates what we said in other podcasts. Everybody is talking about hydrogen. It's one of the name of our podcast, but not all hydrogen is green. Far from it. Most of it is blue or various other colours on the grey and black, and that is well worth remembering in all of this, because some of the clusters do contain hydrogen, and you'd think, well, why are they not using it this way? But actually, they're using it just as a blue hydrogen, which is perhaps slightly cheaper, but it actually doesn't have the same benefits as some of the other. A lot of the talk around there seems to assume that all of this hydrogen is green, and that is far, far from the case as we know, and it's certainly not the cheapest option as we.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm still struggling. I'm not sure there is a blue hydrogen facility anywhere in the world. There's lots of grey hydrogen, but blue hydrogen, which is grey plus CCS, people are talking about that will be the first thing to happen. I'm not sure there is one.
So there's a lot of talk about it without much actually built out and on the ground in some of these.
Yeah, and in that sense, CCS is a bit like hydrogen. There's lots of talk, there's definitely policy shift, policy momentum, I think, to take it seriously. But it's not something that's going to happen. It's not something that's going to suddenly on a big scale happen tomorrow. But it's a kind of long term scale up, and it'll very much be driven by the things we talked about: industrial strategy, policy, long term policy, and kind of long term transition strategies of particular sectors of the world, I would have thought.
Okay, well, thanks. Thanks very much indeed. A lot in this podcast today about CCS, and I suppose we love hearing from our listeners. If listeners have got ideas of discussion topics they would like us to have a go at, please let us know. We'd love to hear from you. We do have a few ideas of things going to be discussed in the coming weeks, but please let us know what you think of what we've discussed today. And if you've got something that we'd like to go into a bit more detail on the discussion, I think we're up to number 31 now, John. This is got quite a number of discussion topics to have a go at there.
Yeah. Okay. Reiterate all that, and we'll see you next time with whatever topic we come up with. Okay.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.